We will call to order the February 3rd, 2016 meeting of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. At this time, we do not have a full quorum, but we will continue with some administrative things as well as our agenda that we have laid out today. But the commission will not be taking any action on those items today. It's to begin the legislative process to put our omnibus bill together for 2016. The first item that is on our agenda today is the minutes from the November 3rd and November 4th, 2015 meeting. Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, I'll move approval of the November 3 minutes.
Coincidentally, the dates are the same, 3rd and 4th of February and 3rd and 4th of November. Representative Erickson moves the minutes from the November 3rd and November 4th meeting. Any corrections to those? Hearing none.
Chair, we could do them together because my move was for the 3rd, but I'll do the 3rd and 4th.
Any Representative Erickson amends her motion for the 3rd and the 4th of November minutes. Any other discussion? Hearing none, seeing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion carries. The next item that's on our list is the actuarial assumptions for MSRS, TRA, and PERA. There's two different items that are under this particular agenda item. One is a motion, which we will take after we are done hearing from MSRS, PERA, TRA, and others regarding interest rate issues. And the motion that we'll be taking that was before us is the actuarial evaluation changes that came into play as a result of some change in mortality expectation. Each of the boards wanted the chance to get an opportunity to talk about this with their members and to put their approval on that. And the commission had heard this, and so this is literally going to be a ministerial task, but we'll have staff give us a little bit more of a background when we get to that item. So what I'd like to do at this time is ask the representatives, I'll defer to the executive director. Do we have testimony coming from MSRS, PERA, and TRA on the first item?
No, I don't believe so. I don't believe the plans are planning to talk about it. Unless, Dave, did you want to speak on the assumptions?
Sorry.
Hello, Mr. Chair. My name is Dave Bergstrom, the director of the State Retirement System.
Welcome, Mr. Bergstrom.
Yep. And last time that we were here, we asked you to hold off on approving the assumption changes. And what it had to do with was with some tables on future life expectancy. So there were tables issued in 2014. They were called the MP 2014 tables. And then just before the meeting, the Society of Actuary came out with new tables called the MP 2015, which actually showed that people, they didn't have as high of a improvement in life expectancy that they did in 2014. All of the pension funds have gone to their boards and adopted those. So I think we're done, and I think everybody is supporting the move to the MPE 2015 tables.
Thank you, Mr. Bergstrom. And I will ask if there's any other public testimony or anyone who would like to speak to this matter that's before the commission. Again, we're not going to take action on we'll take action on the motion, but not on the legislative portion because of a lack of a quorum at this time. Seeing no one rushing to the testifying table, we have no witnesses. Mr. Bergstrom, thanks for your briefing on that. With that, we'll move to the motion, which, again, I had referred to earlier. Mr. Bergstrom kind of did some backgrounding on. And members, that motion is in your packet if you'd like to review that or have questions. And I will ask Ms. Lincheski to offer any comments before we take action on that as well. Ms. Lincheski.
I guess we're separating this out between legislation and the motion because all of the assumptions other than the interest rate change can be approved by the commission and then take effect. So there isn't a need then to have a piece of legislation go into the legislature and be approved for that. There is the one change that needs to be made, and that's the one that we're going to be approving tomorrow in the form of the interest rate change, and that'll be in the legislation. In the motion then, you'll see that the way this is presented is to attach letters from each of the governing boards of the plans. The idea is that under the statute, the governing boards approve changes to their assumptions, and then they present them to the commission, and then the commission can approve them and have them take effect immediately, or cannot approve them, and then they will take effect automatically in a year. The costs of these changes will be presented as part of the sustainability packages. They were also part of the presentation at the November 3rd meeting, but a lot of that was somewhat out of date because it was based on the July 1, 2014 actuarial valuations for the plans. One other item I wanted to mention is that I prepared a memo that sort of goes through the status, why it's separated into a motion and a bill, and then also describes the changes that are included. We can talk about this tomorrow with respect to the bill, but I'll just mention that there is an error in the memo, and it appears on pages 1 and 2, wherein I'm discussing the statutory language and indicating that some cleanup changes needed to be made due to the change in the salary increase assumption. The error actually doesn't relate to the St. Paul Teachers Fund assumption on that point, but rather an error in the statute relating to the local government correctional plan. So there's just a change then, I guess, that please consider as part of my memo there. So just wanted to make the record straight on the fact that there was no change or no error in the St. Paul Teachers. I also, in the memo,
Chairman?
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Lincheski, are you changing language in your memo? I wasn't quite understanding that.
Yeah, I wanted to just note that there is something incorrect in my memo.
And are you going to make that change?
I can make that change this evening.
So that we have it. And you will do
tomorrow.
That. Okay,
yep,
great.
I can do that.
I see. Thank you.
Also, in the memo, I am addressing a question that came up at the November 3rd meeting regarding why the actual experience that we all came to understand based on the experience studies done on all the plans, why the actual experience doesn't exactly match the new proposed assumption for each of the topics. And I went to Deloitte on that point, and in my memo is a fairly lengthy explanation of why the so-called AE ratio is not 100%. And so I won't kind of go through those details, but if you want to read through that and if you have any questions on that issue, I can try to answer them, or we can certainly get more input from Deloitte. Those are my comments.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lincheski, I'm looking at the first page of the letter that you're sending to the MSRS, and I'm just wondering if there is someone in the audience could just give clarification to under the first bullet point. It does talk about decreasing the current interest return assumption from a fairly specific 8 or 8.5% based upon select or ultimate to an investment return assumption in the range of 7 to 8%. I'm just wondering, with that degree of latitude, where they would presume that their target would be. And I'm just wondering if they would be willing to offer some greater level of specificity rather than that latitude. And I'm not trying to, you know, hem them in, but I'm just trying to appreciate why that wider degree of latitude as opposed to what was previously understood. Mr. Chair.
Ms. Lincheski, I don't know if you have some background information on that MSRS. Maybe Mr. Bergstrom would be able to have some background on that for Representative Albright's question.
For the members, I'm looking on the second page on the motion for the letter that would be going out or has gone out to the MSRS participation under the first bullet point.
And Representative Albright, if I am not mistaken, they're kind of face one another. One has a December 28, 2015 date on it, and one has a September 3rd, 2015 date on it.
That is correct.
And you're referring to the one that's dated September 3rd,
yes.
2015.
Yes.
Mr. Bergstrom, welcome back.
Yep. Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, and Representative Albright. So our actuary did a report, and they calculated the assumption range anywhere from 7 to 8%, depending if it was done arithmetically or geometrically, and I'm not a math student, so I can't answer that question. But essentially, what your actuary did when they saw these, Deloitte also agreed with the 8% because they thought that our actuaries had used a relatively short time period in their investment assumption. I think they were using more of a 10-year horizon, where the actuary that you hired recommended using a 20-year assumption. So our board last year and the legislation last year lowered our investment assumption from 8.5 to 8. And that was done already in statute.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bergstrom then, so are you tending to be more in the neighborhood of the 7% or more towards the neighborhood of the 8%, or is this a fluid type of dialogue that we're going to have without a definitive bogey that we're shooting for?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, our definitive bogey is 8%. That's what we put into law. So that's what we have. It would take a law change to lower it from 8 to something lower.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Bergstrom. Thank you, Representative Albright. Other questions? Ms. Lincheski, anything else to offer at this time?
No.
Right.
Thank you.
So we'll take action on the motion portion, and then we believe that we'll have a quorum at some time during this legislative session to move the rest of the information that we have before us here. So with that, is there a motion? Do we have a motion?
I just want to clarify, Mr. Chairman, that so the requirement is that we just have a quorum of the entire commission for this action. But for legislation in the future, we need to have the majority and a quorum on both sides.
Correct. That's okay. My understanding.
I right. Just wanted to clarify. I knew there was something like that.
Yep. Yeah. Thank you for bringing that to folks' attention, because commissions are a whole lot different than committees when they're in their respective chambers and how they conduct business. So, right. Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move a motion.
Motion by Representative Albright to adopt LCPR 16-M1. All those in favor,
Mr. signify. Mr. Chairman, before we take that vote, I hate to be a stickler, but are there 14 members on the commission?
There are, and this is an administrative item, so I was told that we could take action because it's administrative
with
in nature.
7 out of 14 of us here.
And we can wait till tomorrow to look at taking action on it, but we are permitted to take action on it because this is the commission does have the ability to meet and to take administrative action throughout the entire calendar year, not just in session.
I understand, but didn't we just say that we had to have a quorum of the entire commission, which would be 8 people?
Representative Crucia was here, and he had to step out.
All right.
So,
great. So we had 8.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification.
Other questions? If not, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion carries. We are on to item number 3 at this point, which is going to be where a majority of our time will be spent today. As a result of the life expectancy information that we have just talked about and that the plans were made aware of and we as a commission have discussed and were made aware of, as well as change in the rate of return assumptions, that has created some moving parts within the various plans and the benefits. And each of the plan directors is going to appear before the commission today to visit about their sustainability and funding plans to be able to help pay benefits that are due under the various plans. And so what I think I will do is I will ask Mr. Bergstrom to come back up, and we'll start with him. And I'm also going to invite Mr. Anderson from PERA Mr. Anderson is not one of the people who will be presenting today. I will invite Jay Stoffel, the deputy director. I don't see. Oh, there he is. to join as well, because there, I think you're all on one PowerPoint and that presentation and kind of moving back and forth on this. PERA does not have anything before us right now, but is present if there are questions. And then I'll ask Jill Strutz to come forward as well from St. Paul Teachers Retirement as well. And members, there are been distributed to you the packet of information for the PowerPoint presentation. Members of the public back on the information table. There are some additional items as well, and I do not believe that we are going to be using the technology or the screens to be using the conversation here. So if you are interested in learning more, there are some handouts that are in the back. With that, Mr. Bergstrom, I'm going to turn this portion of the discussion over to you and invite you to go ahead and bring the commission and others up to speed on what you've been working on.
All right. Mr. Chair, you should all have a packet in your folders that retirement system financial update. Yeah, exactly. So that is what we'd like to speak from today. And if we would turn to the second page. So as you know, we talked a little bit about this last time. All of the major, the large pension plans had an experience study done. And an experience study basically looks at what the actuary assumes and how that matched with reality. So they look at life expectancy, when people retire. They look at many different things. And they look over a long period of time. So, when we set these assumptions, they're for a long period of time. The recommendations that the actuary made was lowering future wage inflation from 3.75% to 3.5%. They recommended in different forms lowering the investment assumption to 8%, and that is, as we talked about earlier, there was a breadth of different alternatives. And then what we'd really like to focus on today is the mortality changes. And essentially what we have found is that our members are living 2 years longer than what we had experienced. And that's just in the last 15 years. So why does that matter? 2 years longer life expectancy means 2 years longer of benefit payments. So while we're finding employees are working later in their career, roughly a year, we're finding that they're collecting for 2 years longer, males about 2 years and females 2.4, and that's a lot. So that is why we are here today, is specifically to address that issue. If you turn to page 3, we're very fortunate to live in Minnesota in the fact that we live second longest only to the residents of Hawaii. And we're not very far behind Hawaii. So on a positive note, it's great to live a long time. On a financial note, that is...
Mr. Bergstrom, I apologize for interrupting you. Were there enough copies of, I know that the St. Paul teachers, I can see theirs, there was. Did everybody who wanted a copy of this get one?
No.
Okay, I have an extra copy that I would be happy to share with some. And we're actually also going to be putting some additional together. I want folks to be able to have a copy of it if they do have questions and wanting to follow along. So,
Mr. Chair, since they're a hot commodity to help improve our funding, I have a few for sale.
Well, I think that we'll be looking for a gratis on this versus a fundraiser, but I do appreciate the creativity, Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, I try. So.
Yeah, it was.
Should I remove them from the packet, or will that?
I'll just replace those with the ones for tomorrow members, just because I want to have
members of the public having copies of those if they need them. Mr. Bergstrom, again, thank you for the accommodation in putting your comments on pause for a moment. If you will continue with your testimony.
Sure. So again, looking at the map, just to reaffirm that Minnesota's live longer than people in most states. If you look at Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, we're talking about 5 years longer on average, which is a lot. And we noticed that with our own membership, as I said earlier, that the average life expectancy has increased by that roughly a two-year lifespan. So what does that mean for the pension plan? If you look on the next slide, and it shows the graphs. So MSRS had risen to about 91% funded in 2014, and our actuary report this year will show 89% funded, but that was before the mortality change. So when we factor in the mortality change, MSRS funding falls to 84%, PERA is at about 77%, and TRA is at 75%. So you can see how that had such a big impact on the funding of our plans, that longer life expectancy. So that just puts it into perspective. I will hearken back to the days of 2009 when we were at 66, 60, and 54. So we're much better than we were. But this is something that our boards felt we needed to address. And the sooner you address, you know, we address these issues, the better. So specifically at MSRS, if you would look at page 5, the 2014 valuation was on the left, so I won't spend any time on that because that did show us at the 92% funding. The middle column is with the 8% investment assumption that you approved last year, and this is our actual numbers. And if you look at the top line, our liability is $13.1 billion. The second line are our assets of $11.6 billion. If you move to the right with the mortality, the cost of the plan or the liability is increased to $13.8 billion. So that liability went up by $700 million attributable to that higher life expectancy. Our assets didn't change yet. And so you can see where our funding had dropped from 89 to 84. And then if you look at the bottom, we often talk about contribution deficiencies. So we now have a contribution deficiency. A contribution deficiency, if you have no sufficiency or deficiency, you're going to get to full funding at your target date. If you have a sufficiency, you will get there earlier. And with a deficiency, you will either not get there or get there later than expected. So based on that funding, our board decided to address an issue.
Mr. Chair, my name is Jay Stoffel. I'm the Deputy Director of Teachers Retirement Association, and I will follow with a description of similar information on page 6 of your handout.
Thank you, Mr. Stoffel. Continue.
And similar layout, but a little bit different. We show the 2014 valuation, kind of old history. The middle column is a little bit different than what MSRS shows. What we're showing for TRA in the middle column is the 2015 valuation with no assumption changes. And then the last column shows the impact of all the new assumption changes as a result of the experience study work. And the significant changes related to for TRA are the interest rate assumption going from long-term 8.5% to 8% in our proposal this year. That was something the other two plans, MSRS and PERA and St. Paul, did last year. But we wanted to complete our experience study and get all that work done and then recommend a full load of actuarial assumption changes. So the 8% is a big assumption change. And then similar story with mortality. What you heard about MSRS mortality improvements is pretty much the same experience for the TRA. Our teachers are living 2 years longer. Our population is 75% female. Our population is nearly 100% college educated, and we're from Minnesota. Those three factors are very weigh very heavily on the improvement in mortality that we're seeing in our membership. So what we have today with the new assumptions is a funding ratio of 75.4% and a contribution deficiency of 4.5%. And that's the position that we're in with the new assumptions, with the new 8% return assumption, and our proposal that you'll be hearing in a few minutes will address that 4.5% deficiency.
Thank you, Mr. Stoffel. And the next page is going to be the PERA general plan information. And I think what I'm going to do is just allow Mr. Anderson to come down and maybe just talk a little bit about what's on there and why we're not moving forward with PERA at this point in time, and why we have proposals for sustainability from the other three major plans in the state of Minnesota. And that will help us to clarify that in the record. Mr. Anderson, welcome. If you state your name for the record and begin with your testimony.
Yeah, Mr. Anderson. Doug Anderson, Executive Director of PERA. And with our numbers, it's a similar story.
The participants of our plan are surviving as long as the other plans. But there is a counter effect of how the 2.5% COLA trigger works. And I think Mr. Bergstrom will explain that a little bit more momentarily. But that has a little bit bigger of an offset to our liability growth. So whereas for the other two funds, we'd see a liability growing by more than 5% in each case, the liability in our plan only grew by 2%. So it has less of an impact overall. And the result was our funding ratio, while it took a drop in this past year, is still projected to reach 100% in a 30-year time period. And as a result, that there is not an urgency to take action at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Yep.
Page 8, Mr. Bergstrom, I suspect that's where you're going to be picking up again.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Proceed.
So if you would look at page 8, and this is MSRS's sustainability proposals, and we are looking at three different plans this year. I'll start with our general plan, which is our largest plan. And again, the idea behind this is to make sure that our plans are moving towards 100% funding. So what we are proposing is would be, from an employee standpoint, as of July 1 of 2017, increasing employee contributions from 5.5% to 6%, and that increases our revenue by about $13.6 million. We are proposing increasing the employer contribution from 5.5% to 7%, which is 40.9%. The reason that we are proposing our employee and employer contributions in the MSRS general plan have been equal since the early 80s, late 70s, and the reason that we're proposing a difference here is that a lot of these liability changes were caused by longer life expectancy of current retirees. So philosophically, what the board felt is the 0.5% employee and 0.5% employer paid for the longer life expectancy of active employees. So a 30-year-old, a 40-year-old, a 50-year-old still contributing, they are going to live longer as well. So the 0.5% employee and 0.5% employer goes to pay for that. The COLA change and the 1% employer contribution, the additional 1% employer, would to be offset the increased liabilities that we see for deferred members and retired members. So that is why we are proposing a difference. So we would be looking at 5.5% to 6% and 5.5% to 7% for the employer. We're also looking at adjusting the cost of living. This would apply to the unclassified plan and legislators' plan going forward. And we're really proposing two things. Our board is proposing two different items. First one is lowering the cost of living from 2% to 1.75%. That lowers the future growth of benefits and lowers our liabilities. The other thing that we are proposing is eliminating the trigger when it goes back, where it automatically increases back to the 2.5% COLA once we reach 90% funded. So instead of having this automatic increase when we hit that magical 90% rate, we are proposing eliminating that. And we are proposing that for an important funding reason. As we looked at putting this package together, the more we put into the plan didn't help fund the plan. But what it helped do is pay those cost of living adjustments earlier. So what was happening, so if you remember just back 2 years ago, we were 90% funded. We were with 1 year of triggering the 2.5% COLA. Now with the change in life expectancy, we're never going to trigger a COLA. So in those two short years, it swung that much. So what happens when you have the automatic trigger, the money that goes into the plan, all of those dollars go to pay that increase sooner, which increases our liabilities. So when we were looking at solutions, the more money we put in, the more employee and employer dollars we put in, didn't really help the funding of the plan, didn't really help get us anywhere, because we just add on to those liabilities. And we cut almost $600 million of liabilities out at MSRS when we did this in 2010 by lowering that COLA. And if you trigger it back on, you have to add those back in. And so it's a pretty big liability. So our board is proposing eliminating totally that trigger for that plan and our correctional plan because it just causes funding problem. And as we looked at solutions, the more we paid, the more we dug a hole, and we just weren't getting anywhere. So that's an important piece of our proposal. All told, eliminating the trigger and lowering the COLA reduces our liabilities by $400 million. So if you remember right, we increased them. They went up by $700 million with the longer life expectancy. This, of that $700 million, this takes care of $400 million. By lowering the COLAs going forward and eliminating that COLA. For the correctional plan, we still have an experience study that we are working on and will not be ready this session, but the board proposed lowering the 2% COLA to 1.75% in that plan, eliminating the trigger as well in that plan. We're not looking at any contribution rate changes or anything else because the board wanted to look at those experience studies. If you remember back in 2010 and again in 13, we made changes to that plan that increased the early retirement penalties, and we made some changes that I think are changing retirement patterns, which may offset some of the cost of the higher life expectancy because we're seeing people working longer just because of the early retirement penalties work, plus we changed the formula. So we are proposing not to fix it totally this year, but we'd really like to see it may not need any further change than that. We just don't know at this point. So we're not requesting any contribution rate increases for that plan. And then for the judge's plan, we are asking, and it won't be in this bill in front of you, it would be in an appropriation bill, and we are asking for a $6 million annual appropriation to the judges. And the reason we're asking for that, the judge's plan was not pre-funded until 1991. So until that time, it was what we called a terminally funded plan, which sounds horrible, but we would get money when somebody retired, hoping that would be enough to pay for their lifetime. And if we earned 8% and everybody died right on time and the market earned 8%, that would have been fine. But that's not what happens in reality. So when the market dropped, when people lived longer, the money that we had gotten from, you know, as an appropriation just wasn't enough to cover it. So we want to get this plan back on track because it really has lagged for a long period of time. That is not in this bill. We did submit a request to have it included in the governor's budget. We don't know if that will happen, but I just want you to be aware that it is something that we're trying to address as well this year.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bergstrom, who's included in the MSRS judges plan?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, it would be district court judges and higher. And we have about 300 active members, and the plan just was never funded properly.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bergstrom, when you look at the census of your active participants and you look at these changes to the funding mechanism, what disclaimer, if you will, would you put on the sufficiency of these changes to correlate with the outcome if you had either a static or a downturn in the population or the census of those actively participating in the MSR program?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, if you saw a downturn in the number of new participants, it more than likely would require additional changes because now you don't have as many people coming into the plan. So, you know, so that has an impact. It would happen relatively slowly, but that would certainly have an impact. So with our general plan, so the actuary doesn't assume any growth in the plan generally. So, and that's really what I've kind of seen over the last 20 years or so. The number of active members today compared to in our general plan are almost identical. Now it's gone up and down, but if you just ignored that, they're very similar to what they were. The correctional plan, we're actually seeing growth in that plan just because of the, you know, because of the growth in prison usage and other things. That's probably a bad term, prison usage, but it's kind of our growth industry, you might say. And it, and actually, we're seeing that.
That's how headlines get made.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. I hope there are no TVs. So. But anyway, but we have a positive cash flow, or almost a positive cash flow, and it's much easier to fund a plan like that. So it does matter, and our board looks into that, and our actuary builds that in. But if you saw a sharp decline, then it could cause funding problems.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bergstrom, I think you answered the question from, and I, it was, the question was maybe based a little bit rhetorically, but to make sure that you were identifying kind of a static plane in terms of the participation. Obviously, if you're, if you don't have as many participants participating, it there would be a drop-off. I would just, I'm sure that the actuary has some type of disclaimer in terms of what that drop-off meaningfully would have to be before these funding scenarios would have a material change to them. So I guess maybe getting some observation about what the actuary would observe about that would be something meaningful, I think, to the committee. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I don't have that, but I certainly can get a comment or get their comment.
At his convenience, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Bergstrom, Representative Albright. And Mr. Bergstrom, if you would like to continue with your presentation.
So, Mr. Chair, if you would just look at page 9 and all of the, we're talking a lot of numbers. This just graphically shows where we're at and where we hope to go. So this is for our general plan. And you can see we're at about 84% funded to start. And the red line shows where we will end up if we do nothing. That assumes we're going to earn 8% over time. And it in the year 2041, it pulls us down to roughly that 75%. With the package that we are proposing, you can see that all things, if they work, would see us at 100% funded roughly in 2038 or so. So it puts us on an upward trajectory, which we think is important. And you can see that our funding would improve, our funding ratio would improve to 87%. We'd actually have a slight sufficiency using a market value of assets. So it's just a graphic way to show what the results of the package will be. For our correctional plan on page 10, right now we're at roughly 73%. It would immediately move us up to 75, but again, you see it climbing up to 81 and 88%. So that plan, even today with nothing, is moving in the right direction, but our board really felt important to accelerate that upwards to get that moving closer to 100% as well. And then on page 11 shows the impact on the $6 million appropriation for the judge's plan, where you can see that if we do nothing, this plan in 2039 will be in about the 25% funded ratio, and this would move it back up to the 88%. So it makes a huge difference, that additional money.
Mr. Bergstrom, just a little bit more on the judge's plan. You said that it had been, and these are my words, not specifically yours, but inappropriately funded for the type of plan that it was or is. Were those payments coming from the general fund as direct appropriations, and so there wasn't money that was set aside like there would be for the other plans, where there to be an employer contribution and an employee contribution?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. So the judges would pay in, but the state wouldn't pay in until the person retired, much like what we do for legislators. So you're under those in the legislators' plan, the legislators pay in, but the state doesn't pay it until the person actually retires. And so it's just not a great way to fund a retirement plan.
And Mr. Bergstrom, that has been corrected back in 1991, if I recall your testimony correctly, that there would be moving from that type of situation, but we're still having, if I can use that term, a little bit of a gap between where we are and where we need to be to bridge. Is that what I'm hearing?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. So it actually worked very well through the 90s when the market was going up. We had grown to about 70% funded, but since the early 2000s, we've had a couple of tough times in the market, and we just have lost that steam. So this would be to pick it back up.
And Mr. Bergstrom, one other question relative to the scoping of the proposal: how many years would we be looking at the state making additional appropriations of $6 million?
Mr. Chair, right now about 25, could be more, could be less, but roughly that the plan would be to do it until we reach our full funding date, which is about 24, 25 years out.
That's your anticipation right now based on your actuarial work.
Mr. Chair, correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bergstrom, and that's $6 million a year?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, that is correct.
So a $12 million biennium obligation. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bergstrom, and when would that start?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we are hoping for this coming July. The sooner the better.
Seeing no other questions on this topic, Mr. Bergstrom, we'll just ask you to stand by. And slide 12 looks like we've got a run-through from TRA. So, Mr. Stoffel, I'm going to turn this part of the program over to you. Sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Page 12 is information about the sustainability program that has been approved by the TRA Board of Trustees. And I would point out that we've met several times over the summer, fall, early winter here. We've had several meetings with our stakeholder groups. We've met with active employees, the unions. We've met with the retired groups, and we've met with the employer groups. Many, many meetings with all the stakeholders. We've had several board meetings addressing the 4.5% payroll contribution deficiency that we currently have that we're trying to solve. So this is a culmination of all that work, all those meetings and conversations. And so our program really is in three major areas, the first one being contribution rates. What we're proposing is to leave employee contribution rate the same at 7.5% the way it is today, and then increase the employer contribution rate by 1% from 7.5% to 8%. That would be effective next biennium, July 1, 2017. That change would generate $43 million a year for the TRA plan. $41 million of that would be through the public school system and about $2 million a year from the MNSCU system. The second part of the program involves cost of living adjustment that we currently have. Right now we have a 2% cost of living adjustment, and we also have the triggers that are currently present in the MSRS funds, as Mr. Bergstrom explained. So our proposal is to reduce our 2% COLA. The first part of the change would be to go down to a 1% cost of living adjustment, effective immediately. The first one would be this January of 2017. It would be reduced to 1%. It would stay at 1% for the next 5 years, and then it would go back up to 1.75% thereafter. Part of the cost of living adjustment change also involves removal of the triggers for the very same reasons that you heard, the funding problem associated with the triggers, putting more money in. All it's doing is moving your cost of living adjustment increase sooner and not really gaining any ground. So those would be the components of the cost of living adjustment change. And then the third piece is changing our amortization period. Currently, we're at a date of 2037 for full funding, and we would propose to move that out to a new 30-year period to 2046. And those three components would generate 4.2% of pay and bring us down to a 0.3% deficiency. It's not eliminating all of it, but it's leaving us with a very small amount of deficiency. It takes $1 billion off of the books for actives and retirees, and it attains 100% full funding within that 30-year period. The pie chart on the right side of that page meant to demonstrate a little bit of additional work that we did. And what we're showing you here is it's a present value calculation, and it's meant to show what we are trying to come up with. One of the guiding principles that the TRA board has is to try to have this program and the effort towards resolving this issue shared equally by employees, employers, and retirees. So we've got three groups that we're trying to spread the pain across, or if you want to call it that. So the perfect pie would be equal 33% pieces, but we came to something fairly close. And you can see the yellow part of the pie, the retirees are putting in 34% of the effort, obviously a reduction in a cost of living adjustment from 2 to something less, and removal of the trigger to 2.5, that's a decrease in future cost of living adjustments. That provides 34% of the solution and is worth $627 million in terms of present value of that liability. Employers with a 1%, well, I'm going to talk about the orange piece, the next piece. The active members are putting in 27% towards this solution. And it's not as obvious for employees, for active members, because they're not getting a cost of living adjustment, so there's no cut to a cost of living adjustment to them. They're not getting an employee contribution rate increase, but it is a reduction of their future cost of living adjustment. Mm-hmm. If someone is within 5 years of retirement, say you're an active teacher today, you're within 5 years of retirement, you will feel a part of that 1% cost of living adjustment instead of a 2, and in the future you'll never see a 2. It'll be a 1.75% cost of living adjustment. So the reduction in the cost of living adjustment is the reduction to active member benefits, and we can quantify that to be $487 million over the next 30 years. So that provides 27% of the solution. And the third piece, the blue slice, the 39%, that is the present value of the 1% over the next 30 years, $43 million coming into the fund over the next 30 years on a present value generates $713 million. So that's roughly a one-third split between those three groups and meets the principle that we're trying to achieve with sharing this across those three groups. And I think that's, well, I'll go on to the next page unless there are any questions. The next page.
Stoffel, I think Representative Erickson has a question. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stoffel. So the 39% that employers are going to contribute as an increase over 30 years is about, it's over $20 million a year then additional that they'll have to set aside in their contribution. Is that correct?
Well,
Mr. Stoffel.
Chair, Representative Erickson, the 1% employer contribution generates $43 million a year.
Right.
Yeah, so in terms of present value over the next 30 years, that's worth $713 million today. That's a present value calculation. So
okay.
It's discounted for.
Thank you.
Mr. Stoffel, proceed
right.
with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 13, similar kind of information that you saw from the MSRS side of things. You can see the first column comes down to a contribution deficiency of 4.5%. And with the sustainability measures, we're reducing the very top row of information. $27.1 billion is our actuarial accrued liability before the changes, $26.1 billion after. So there's the reduction of $1 billion off of our books as a result of the changes we're proposing. Our funded ratio improves to 78% immediately. And goes on a positive track. The blue line on the left side, the line graph on the left side of the page shows the blue line with the changes that we're proposing. The red line is if we do nothing, if we make no changes today or into the future, and if all our actuarial assumptions are met going forward, we would experience the red line. We would remain flat or slightly decreasing and stay around 74% funded. We don't think that's the proper thing to do. We believe we need to make these changes going forward. We need to be ready to take on more market volatility possibly. 100% funded ratio is where we really believe we need to be. So these changes, in essence, get us there over a 30-year period, and the 4.5% deficiency is reduced down to a small 0.3% number.
Mr. Stoffel, Executive Director Lincheski has a follow-up question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One part of the bill that we put together to assist with the sustainability package for TRA includes something that you referred to, the return to work reforms. Since that is in the bill, could you, and there is a handout in the package, could you address that, please?
Mr. Stoffel.
Mr. Chair, yes, there is a handout. It's got some red shading in it. It's I can explain it if you can find it. That's fine, but that's correct, and I'm glad I was asked about that because it is.
Mr. Stoffel, just for clarity, the document that you were showing, is it included in the packet or is it a separate item?
It's a separate one-page document. It's titled TRA Reemployed Annuitant Reforms.
It's in this collection, which includes the bill and a memo from staff, and then the item sort of between those two is this colorful handout.
Can you tell us what the bill is?
Oh, yes. It's LCPR 16-014.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering, because you've had the increase in the employer side of it, do you have the runs by school district of what that would mean for each of the schools across the state? And then also, Mr. Chair, for you, I assume that at some point we're going to have folks be able to come up and testify and provide feedback on this. Is that going to be after the document's complete, or what is the plan?
The plan, Representative Anderson, is that we will take all three of the plans that are here, and then we have some people who have asked to testify, and then we'll open it up to members of the public at that point. So
great.
I suspect we'll have a bit more robust discussion once we're done with the presentations.
Okay. And then to my point, do you have the runs for that for by each school district?
Mr. Stoffel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't have that information today, but I understand what you're looking for, the $41 million spread across all of the school districts. We've done a little bit of work in that in the past. In 2010, we sort of looked at this, and as sort of a rule of thumb, I think every 1% increase in employer contribution had an impact on the general operating budget of a school district, something in the neighborhood of 0.25% to 0.5%, depending on the school district. But I think we can come up with the amount by close approximation by school district of the 1%.
And
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I appreciate that. I know that our fiscal staff, too, can help put that together. So I don't know if Ms. Lincheski can convene with you to help see that gets done in an accurate reflection so we have a better idea of what we're looking at.
Mm-hmm. And Representative Anderson, to your question, the people who have provided advance notice of their desire to testify all appear to be from school districts. So I suspect we'll be getting a little bit better backgrounding on that information as well. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, if the state paid the funding, would it still have an individual impact on the school districts?
Mr. Stoffel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, if the full impact was covered by the state, then there would be no impact on school districts then.
The $41 million each year.
Correct. If it could be, in essence, a pass-through. I mean, it could be handled various ways. And the TRA board is supportive in principle of that idea. And we've been talking to our employer groups about that idea and would like to work with our employer groups towards that end. But if it's an increase in the school formula or an appropriation of some kind that would be an amount equal to the $41 million for the public schools, then the districts would have no impact on their budgets.
Other questions at this time? Seeing none and hearing none, well, Mr. Stoffel, did you have any other comments that you wanted to make on your presentation at this time?
I wanted to address the comment from Ms. Lincheski on the other part of our sustainability
Proceed.
Program. And it's part of our sustainability bill, but there's some other good policy reasons why we're proposing the next thing that I'm about to describe. So what happens in TRA if, let's say, we have members, teachers retire, and for various reasons, they are incented to go back to work. In many cases, in most of the cases, actually, 80% of this activity of retirees going back to work is in terms of substitute teachers. Substitutes are paid generally $100 a day, maybe $120, $130 a day, something like that, to fill in for the school districts. So they have the retirees have an interest in doing that, the districts have a need for that, and that program is working well, and we don't want to really disturb that all too much. But one thing that we believe is that today, when a retiree returns to a position as a sub or in any position at all, whether it's full-time or part-time, mm-hmm. there are no employee or employer contributions that are paid on that position. So that's the first change we'd like to make, and require that only employer contributions are paid on those positions. So the full, today, 7.5% contribution rate would be paid on any reemployed annuitant position. And eventually, if our proposal goes forward, that rate would be 8.5%. We are not suggesting that employee contribution rates change because that presents some problems with paying people a benefit and charging them contributions. It's most likely we'd have to stop their pension if that were to occur. So we don't want, and I think that would greatly disturb the substitute teacher program that's operating as it's operating today. I don't think teachers would go back as they do now if they understood that their pension would have to stop, because now we have to start taking in contributions, recalculate their pension at the end of that employment, and start paying them again at that point. I think that would create a disincentive for people to go back into the schools at that point.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, Mr. Stoifel. Could you explain that a little bit more to me? So currently, substitute teachers, neither the employer nor the employee pays into the pension fund. And what's the rationale then for adding the employer? Since the retiree, you know, the contributions theoretically are already made by both the employer and the employee for their pension fund, why does the substitute teaching change? Would they collect more money as a result of their substitute teaching that would necessitate more money going into the fund? You know, does it affect their pension at all? I was just curious about that.
Right. Mr. Stoffel.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, the policy reason I think that we're driving at here is, well, there's a couple things. These are TRA-covered positions, and right now I think one could argue that there's an incentive for employers to hire retirees in these positions because there's no employer contribution. And therefore, it could be an employment issue where there's other teachers, younger teachers, wannabe teachers out there who would like to have the job, but if they're substitute teachers, that's really not a young person's market. But if it's a full-time position, those positions could be competitive for both younger people or retirees. So it's an employment issue, number one. There's these are TRA-covered positions, and we believe there should be employer contributions coming in regardless of who is in that position. And the second would be there's this incentive to hire the retirees versus a younger person.
Senator Pappas, follow up.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Stoifel, there's an incentive currently.
Yes.
And so it would even the playing field between a retiree and hiring a younger person to be the substitute. And sometimes the substitute teacher is the kind of the gateway to a full-time job.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, that could be. It's different. It's not always universal, so things operate differently in different schools. But, right, there's currently there is no employer contribution. So currently the incentive, if you're an employer, saying I've got an opening here, if I put a retiree in there, I don't have to pay the 7.5% employer contribution. If I put somebody else in there, they're going to come to work and they're going to be employed. There's going to be employee and employer contributions. So from the employer's standpoint, it's an extra 7.5% that they're going to be paying because it's a person who has not yet retired.
Mm-hmm. Representative Albright.
Mr. Stoffel, from a plan provisions perspective, if you irrevocably terminate your service and you accept then the pension, then come back as a part-time substitute teacher, aren't you also then interfering with the plan provisions for years of service, eligibility, provisions for a rehire? I mean, we're going, layers and layers and layers deeper than what, this provision calls for, but aren't you complicating the issue of a retiree coming back who's already started the receipt of their pension, only to come back then and have to pay into the same system as you described just for the sake of participant as a substitute teacher? I think you've got cross currents working here for the sake of realizing a contribution to a participant who's already on pension distribution, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Stoffel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, the 1% employer contribution has no bearing on the employee. So they're retired, they're getting their pension, now they're back to work as a substitute teacher, so they've got some income from that job. The pension isn't changing at all, they're not earning additional service credit, so their pension stays the same. And the current law allows this to occur, it's re-employed annuitants. We do have, I'm going to talk next about an earnings limitation that we have in place. There's a $46,000 earnings limitation where if a person stays under that dollar amount, then there's really no impact whatsoever on the retiree. They keep their full pension, they're earning something as a substitute teacher, and there's really no effect on that person. What we're proposing is in that employment arrangement is only that there be employer contributions. So that generates $3 to $4 million a year for the TRA fund if this change were to take place statewide. We put it in our sustainability program. I think there's some good policy reasons to do this, but it's a revenue small, but it's a revenue piece for the plan as well. And maybe to complete the thought process, I can go a little. I'm going to talk next about this earnings limitation and how we are proposing to change that also.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
I hate to begrudge the testifier, but from a standpoint of a couple of questions then. Is there a minimum threshold for hours of service eligibility in order for that contribution to be triggered? And secondarily, if they're not receiving benefit, but yet it's triggering a contribution, not inuring to them, but to others in the system, from an ERISA perspective, understandably that your pension plan may not be entirely availed of those obligations, but aren't you acting in a partially discriminatory function towards that participant because they are not inuring a benefit, even though a benefit is being provided to them for their service to that employer?
Mr. Stoffel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright. First question, there is no minimum. So a teacher goes back into the classroom and earns $1, there's a contribution. We have no minimum threshold. So contributions are due on any kind of employment associated with that position. On the second point, we are not covered by ERISA. So number one, we're not in violation of any sort of federal regulation here. And I understand what you're getting at. There's a benefit or there's a payment going into the plan and it's not inuring to the member. I guess maybe what we could argue is that the member who's retired is collecting a pension and doesn't have to give up that pension in order to go back to work. I've heard it described as one of the best part-time jobs available. You call in, see what's available, decide to go into work that day or not. You continue to receive your pension. If we were to have employee contributions, again, pensions, I think, would have to stop. And there's in-service distributions we have to be careful of. So we are not requiring annuitants to put a hold on their pension. Money's going into the plan for the employer part, but you're right. It doesn't inure to the employee.
So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Stoffel,
Representative Albright,
the question would be then this would be conforming to Taft-Hartley provisions under a pension plan.
Mr. Stoffel.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Albright, we're not governed by either ERISA or Taft-Hartley.
Representative Albright.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
I have a question, and I have a question that I don't know the answer to. And you brought up about young people that might not be hired for as a teaching spot, but if they came in to substitute, does that count as service for retirement?
Mr. Stoffel.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, yes. Johnson, I'm sorry. Yes, we have our eligibility rules, and in essence, it's if you just sort of want to boil it down to a simple rule, we don't follow this universally, but if a teaching position or a position in the school building requires a teaching license, then that position is covered by TRA. Anybody who comes to work for one day or half a day or part-time, full-time is covered by the TRA. I think there may be some minimums in other plans, but we have no minimum. So our eligibility rules are a little bit more complex than that and not as universal as I just described, but just as an example.
Thank you.
Mr. Stoffel, I just want to kind of summarize because we did get an opportunity to hit a lot of different things on here. What you're proposing right now is that a retired teacher who is called back on a short-term or long-term call sub position, my assumption being, that they would not be required to pay the 7.5% employee contribution because they are currently an annuitant in the plan. And you're not, at this time, there's no requirement for the employing school district to pay that 7.5%. However, if you are not drawing a TRA pension and you are being asked to do a short or long-term call sub position, you would be subject to paying the 7.5% and so the employing entity. Did I summarize that correctly?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
And what you're proposing is that in the retired situation, the employer be required to pay, whether it's a pensionee or an annuitant or not, to continue to pay the 7.5%.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. For every TRA-covered position, we believe there should be an employer contribution.
And then my assumption would be that that provides equity within, you know, I don't know if I necessarily want to say within generational or age, but whether you're drawing a pension or you're just entering the career hoping to maybe secure a pension at some point in the future, you're not being discriminated against because of what your employer would be required to pay for your services to be a short or long-term call sub. Am I summarizing that succinctly enough?
Mr. Chair, that is correct as well.
Thank you.
The additional pieces of this change that we're proposing related to this program, this reemployed annuitant program, relates to individuals who, same situation, reemployed annuitants who go back to work. Now we have an example where a person exceeds the $46,000 earnings limitation. As long as this reemployed annuitant stays under the $46,000, no impact. They keep their pension, they've got a paycheck coming, and everything is okay. Currently, if a person exceeds the $46,000, and I'll just use an example, let's say a person makes $50,000. They're $4,000 over the limit of $46,000. So the following year, we take half of that excess, or $2,000, and we reduce their pension the following year by $2,000. We take one half of the excess over the limit. We reduce their pension by $2,000, we hold it for a year, and then we give it back to them with no interest. And based on some of the expressions, I see that expression on teachers' faces and others' faces. It's, you know, why in the world would we do that? This law has evolved over many years, and it's changed, and we want to take it back to the way it was. Instead of reducing the pension by $2,000, then giving it back to them, we are proposing that $2,000 be forfeited to the TRA plan, and the forfeiture, it becomes a forfeiture rather than right now it's a deferral. It's a $2,000 deferral. And to make this a little bit easier on retirees, we're going to keep the, you know, we're not proposing to change the $46,000, but the one half, the $1 for every two over the limit, we propose to change $1 for every three. So the penalty amount is smaller, but it becomes a forfeiture instead of deferral. And that's the way the law was several years ago. And at that time, it changed to what we have today because there are retirees who want to come back to work, and there's employers who want these people to come back to work, and there was this block of having this forfeiture. So the laws were changed to do what we're doing today. But I can't explain to you a good policy reason for doing what we're doing, reducing a pension by $2,000 and then giving it all back to a person. Matter of fact, there wasn't too long ago, we were paying 6% on those deferral amounts, and it was incenting people to exceed the limits because it could get them 6%. And it was a perverse incentive. We were trying, you know, if you think of the origination of this law and the policy, the behavior was completely the opposite. It did not stop things from happening. It actually encouraged it to happen. But now the interest has been eliminated from these accounts. But I really can't give you a good reason why do we hold money back and then give it back to a person a year later? It's not accomplishing anything as far as I can tell policy-wise. So the proposal would be to initiate or to go back to the forfeitures. And we're suggesting that this be implemented. We need a little bit of lead time to do this. If the law does go into place, we need some time. We're proposing this have an effective date of 2020. Because there are some new players on the scene. We have third-party employers for substitute teachers these days. That's becoming somewhat common. There's companies that are now handling the it's like a temp agency, in essence, really, for school districts. If a school district needs part-time employees, they can call a company and get teachers in the buildings, retired teachers or other kinds of people involved who are qualified to go into the schools and be substitute teachers. So to monitor these earnings limitations, we don't have any regular reporting relationship with these third-party employers right now. So we need to figure out how all that's going to work. There are some who will say that maybe the earnings limitations aren't high enough. We've got some issues to sort out. And I guess what we're suggesting is that passing the law will, if we have enough lead time, get us to work on those issues and be ready to go by a 2020 effective date. The first part of what I described, the employer contribution rate on these positions, we're proposing to have that effective upon enactment, but this second piece of the forfeiture would be an effective date of the year 2020.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stoffel, if a St. Paul teacher went on retired from the St. Paul teachers group and decided to go to the cabin and live at the cabin and become a substitute teacher in a school district, and they've never paid into TRA, would that substitute teacher from St. Paul, who's on pension from St. Paul, would that person have to pay their TRA 7.5%?
Mr. Stoffel, I'm going to just add to Representative Murphy's comment, because I was thinking the exact same thing. I'm just going to broaden it out so we don't have to maybe have additional follow-up questions. If you are from any Minnesota pension, because you might have been a teacher in your retirement, decided that you wanted to activate your teacher's license after having worked under covered service for PERA or MSRS, how would that bill be handled as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, in your example, the answer would be that for that individual, there would be an employer contribution made under our proposal, but the individual would not be under an earnings limitation because they're coming from the St. Paul system, and that pension is coming from that system going into a TRA-covered position. So the earnings limitation, the person can avoid. It's really down to the St. Paul teachers. It was Duluth and Minneapolis. We had these various first-class city plans, but that situation only exists now with the St. Paul retirees. They can go somewhere else outside of the St. Paul School District as a retiree, work in a position covered by TRA, and not be under the earnings limitation. In every other case across the state, any retiree from any school district can go back to work in any school district and be under these earnings limitations, unless they go into the St. Paul School District, then they won't be under the earnings limitation.
And Mr. Stoffel, just to kind of round out our conversation from today, where we were talking about school districts that would hire short or long-term call sub teachers, and if you came from the St. Paul teachers plan, you would be expected to pay as the district the 7.5% then, because they are not a TRA covered. The school district would be a TRA-covered district, but the teacher came from Minneapolis or from the St. Paul school plan.
Yes, Mr. Chair, yes. If the person is a retiree from St. Paul pension fund and coming into a TRA-covered position, there would be an employer contribution rate on that, correct?
And then to Representative Albright's question earlier, would that person be then required as a St. Paul teacher in a TRA-covered building or district, be required to pay the employee match on that?
Mr. Chair, no. No, we're not requiring any employee contributions on.
I'm not trying to place dump the band.
No,
we kind of went down this a little bit
I'm
here.
Pausing.
Kind
of pause for a moment. There's a lot of different scenarios. I need a matrix here in front of me.
Sure.
If it's a St. Paul retiree going into a TRA-covered job, that person would be required to pay the 7.5 employee contributions, and the employer contribution would be paid as well.
Thank you.
Yes.
Representative Albright.
So, Mr. Stoffel, I am a St. Paul teacher, and I moved to Moorhead, Minnesota, and I am covered under their TRA program in that school district, but I'm retired. And I am acting in the capacity as a substitute short call teacher in that school district. From $1 earned, my new school district is responsible for making a 7% contribution to the TRA pension, not for my benefit, but for those that are in that school district, benefiting those that are actively full-time people in that school district.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright.
I have a nod from a former teacher down here, so I think I made myself pretty clear.
Mr. Stoffel, go ahead. I think I know where you're going to go with this, and I think I know it's puzzling you on the question as well.
Well, Well, I think you're asking, and does the money go to the benefit of the teachers in Moorhead?
And you've said yes to that, but not to the short call teacher that's retired.
Well, I need to clarify. Nothing really goes to the benefit of the Moorhead teachers. All the public school teachers.
It goes into TRA.
Are one TRA.
I understand.
Okay.
I understand that. But in the same sense, the benefit is derived only by those remaining in the system, not by the retired person who is, in a sense, being used as a census increase for the obligation inured to the pension. So they're being used for their activity only, not for the benefit derived by them coming out of the plan. That would be a true statement.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, that's true.
Can you see the dichotomy of where the rub is?
Mr. Stoffel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I see the point. The point is well taken. But again, I would suggest to you that there's nothing that requires that person to stop their pension, go back to work, and receive a paycheck. And
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
The point is not to be suggested that the short substitute teacher is not receiving a benefit in as much as it is the obligation of the employer to fund for a retiree that's out of the system. You're increasing the census artificially, in my opinion.
Mr. Scoff, I don't know if you want to comment on that.
Let's move on.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a whole lot more to add, but I understand the point.
To this topic, I'm going to ask those who are interested maybe to schedule a separate outside conversation with Mr. Stoffel and some of the other folks from TRA in the essence of time on this, because that's not the majority of our work here today. It is a component of it. I think we need to move on at this point in discussion. Mr. Stoffel, any other wrapping comments? Because I see page 14 is PERA. I'll give Mr. Anderson a chance to come down and just give us his 10-word, nothing's changed since he saw us the last time, not here today, but since he does have a slide, I want to give him an opportunity to comment on that. Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, you have 8 words left. page 14 just shows our funded ratio starting at 77%, and now the expectation after the demographic and mortality changes that it would reach 100% in the year 2045. Ultimately, this is what our board looked at in deciding that current action wasn't necessary to take. They did evaluate various options, did struggle with the way that the 2.5% COLA trigger works, and recognized the challenge of trying to make adjustments to that and work within the realms of shared sacrifice and intergenerational equity. But realizing that that's complex and that there wasn't an urgent need to take action, again, ultimately, this is why action is being deferred. And we'll continue to monitor the situation and look for opportunities that they need to be addressed.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Okay. Thank you.
Page 15, it looks like we have some wrap-up information. Mr. Bergstrom, are you going to wrap us up and take us to the conclusion today of the presentation?
Mr. Chair, I'll quickly try to go through the remaining pieces. And page 15 of this previous presentation that we were on before shows some historical information about the liability reductions that occurred because of legislation passed in 2010 and 2013. $6.8 billion was removed off the balance sheets of the pension funds due to that legislation. And this, the proposals in the 2016 legislation from the statewide plans would generate $1.4 billion in liability reduction. Just wanted to give you a kind of a sum total of all the changes and then the liability reductions there. Next couple of pages relate to some employee and employer contribution rates in the state of Minnesota versus U.S. Other public plans. This information is all comparable. It's all for Social Security covered employees. Employees around the country who are not covered by Social Security, there are teachers and public employees around the country that are not covered. Therefore, their contribution rates are higher in those public plans, and the benefits are therefore higher. But this is an apples and apples comparison. So you can see the employee and employer contribution rates for the three statewide plans. And in the U.S., the employee average is 6%. The employer average is 11.5%. So that gives you a sense as to where Minnesota stands with contribution rates relative to the rest of the plans in the country. Page 17 is a similar kind of comparison. Again, this is Social Security covered plans. And we're showing you a graph of normal cost, which is the cost of the benefit that employees earn every year. This doesn't include the amortization of unfunded liability. That's a cost to a plan, and it doesn't include administrative expenses. So this is the normal cost of the pension plans. And in MSRS, for example, their normal cost is 8.5%, and the employee contribution rate currently covers 65% of that. You can see the numbers for PARA and TRA. But on a U.S. average, normal cost is much higher, around 13%, and employees are putting in over just almost half. I believe the pension principles that you operate under indicate an even split of normal cost, 50-50, employee and employer. So anyway, that's some comparative information of how it works in Minnesota, how things look relative to other plans around the country. And the last page I'll wrap up with is page 18. Minnesota is not like other states. So a lot of the headlines that we hear all the time are the plans and the funds and the states that do have very significant problems with a real crisis on their hands. That is not Minnesota. We have disciplined funding. We have had proactive pension reform, modest benefits, and so forth. I won't go through all these things on the page, but we really appreciate working with the legislature. These are tough issues. We're tackling them head on. We're not sitting on the wayside. This is not easy stuff to discuss with our shareholder groups. I can tell you that none of our shareholder groups are excited about the program we're promoting, but I guess there's an equal sense of dislike by all of them. So I guess that's the best we can achieve is an equal sense of dislike, but it's really for the good of the plan and to have a sustainable fund going forward, and we hear that all the time. So it is good to work with the legislature on trying to resolve these issues and have a sustainable program going forward.
Thank you, Mr. Stoffel. And we do have some supplementary information in here. I don't know if there is need to discuss any of those items. It's things that folks have seen sort of where the money goes when it's collected as far as expenses and some of those other kinds of things. With that, gentlemen, thank you for your time. I'm going to ask you to be on standby here as we bring in St. Paul teachers. And they will give their presentation, and then we will take the testifiers and I'm sure a few more member questions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Before you go and do that, if I could just catch MSRS, I would be interested in that area in particular in getting some alternatives to see what numbers would look like if you went to an employer increase of 6% rather than the 7%. And then also a little bit greater detail, too, on the return rate and what happens. You've got it at the 8%, but the range was 7 to 8%. I'd like to see some other alternatives and looking at what the numbers would look like for that, if you could. That doesn't have to be here, just offline. If you could provide that detail to me, it would be very helpful.
Yep. I would just ask, as we always try to do, providing that to all members so that they have the benefit from the commission on that. Right. With that, we will shift gears then to the St. Paul Teacher Retirement Fund. Ms. Schertz, welcome, and thank you for your patience today as we are ready to hear from you. And there is a separate handout that folks should have secured that looks like this, and there are copies of that. I know that I can see it from here, still available on the table if folks are interested in that. So with that, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and begin with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jill Schertz. I'm the Executive Director of the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association. I know that the three Minnesota state plans have spent some time with you already this year. This is our first appearance before the commission, so if you'll indulge us, we promise not to take too long, but we thought it might be helpful just to take a moment with a review of the background and structure of the organization, and then we'll address some of the same topics you've heard today already. So first, page one, just a very quick overview. Obviously, our organization serves the teachers of St. Paul. We have been doing that, providing their retirement security since 1909. And just in case there was any doubt about the truth of our statement, we dug the organizational documents up out of the vault and thought we'd present them here. We have a best practices governance structure. We are governed by a board of trustees, which includes an ex officio member from our employer unit, as well as a mix of active and retired teachers. We're subject to oversight, obviously, by the legislature and this commission. We're audited annually by the Office of the State Auditor. I'm pleased to report that we have just completed that audit cycle with the highest rating and unmodified rating, and that covers both our investment program as well as the benefits administration. Like several of the other plans, all of our actuarial and funding calculations are performed by an independent outside actuarial agency. I believe they're here today, Gabriel Roeder Smith. And then, at least we hope you agree with us, we are professionally managed by an experienced staff, and other than myself just celebrating a year here, this staff is very long-tenured, very dedicated to what they do. Not to imply I'm not, just that I don't have long tenure. On the next page, I thought I'd take just a second to describe who our members serve, because at the core, that's why we're here. Our members, and I know that there is some argument about this, a little bit of pride involved. As recently as 2 days ago, I was told we were the largest district in the state. I think there's some back and forth on that, so I've decided to go with a more neutral one of the largest districts in the state. But there can be no doubt our district is certainly one of the most diverse. And as you look at our diversity wheel, it tells a very clear picture, but I think it's even more diverse than that. Within each of these categories, it can be broken down much further from West African, East African, Somali, Hmong, et cetera, et cetera. This incredibly diverse population is served by our teachers, and in doing so, our teachers need to deal with over 100 languages and dialects. They're also on the front line of poverty. Over 72% of our student population is eligible for some sort of reduced or free lunch. You know, no offense, Mr. Bergstrom, but I guess we're the counterpoint. Our teachers are sort of the tip of the spear at dealing with preventing the growth of the correctional program in some respects. And all joking aside, we do look at this and we say our teachers are on the front line of dealing with so many of the most important issues we face as a society, that being poverty, immigration, the fundamental right to a fair and equal education. As we flip the page, we'll talk a little bit about what the makeup of our membership looks like, our 11,000 teachers. I was, I guess, surprised when I took the job that we are 73% women, only 27% men. And when we get done talking about mortality, it will not surprise you to find me recruiting male teachers at this meeting. So any able-bodied male person in the room, we invite you to join our ranks to help our mortality. In addition, our teaching community is, I think, more diverse than the average Minnesota, 20% non-Caucasian. And then notwithstanding, I think, sometimes what's reported in the press, that recipients of pension plans are entitled and wealthy, our teachers are no such things. Their salaries fall solidly within the middle class, in certain instances, the lower middle class. And as well, these are not people that take their pensions and fly away to Florida. Over 88% of our benefit recipients stay right here in 59 counties. So although we clearly have a St. Paul bias, our retirees spread themselves in Minnesota over 59 counties, with $95 million of benefit payments remaining in the state. We think that contributes meaningfully to the state's financials, both in terms of consumer spending and taxes. Just a very quick overview of our demographics. Again, I mentioned 11,000 members. You can see that's divided amongst our actives and retirees. Again, dominated by women. And as you may recall from prior conversations, we actually run two plans, one called the basic and one the coordinated. We now have only 5 remaining members as active teachers in that basic program. So for purposes of this presentation, when we talk about the remainder of our numbers, we're going to focus on our coordinated plan because that's really where the active membership is today. Again, like you've heard from the other plans, we have seen some of the efforts made in previous sessions come to fruition. Our average retirement age has increased to 62.7. And again, when you look at the retirement benefits that are actually paid, These are probably more modest than you might expect. Our average coordinated member, $1,553 a month. The basic plan, we only point out this appears to be higher. It is because these participants receive no Social Security, so they paid in higher during their working years, and their benefit is higher to compensate for no Social Security. So here we stand today, back before you, and before we go on to the mortality question, I know it's always a question, as it should be, how is St. Paul doing? And I'm very pleased to report that this commission and the legislature has worked very hard over the last 5+ years on this plan. And, you know, we want to walk you through how that is borne out. First of all, on our board side, I think they've done an extremely good job at being proactive to adopt fiscally conservative and important measures. I think we've been at the forefront of reducing our cost of living adjustments. Again, that's not always a popular thing to do for a board, but they haven't hesitated. We moved from a traditional variable formula to a flat 1%. They took a freeze for 2 years. Last year, we started to eliminate and did eliminate our CPI-based adjustment provision. Originally, when we started the session last year, we had as our ultimate rate CPI plus 5%. Our board agreed that that was not sustainable should that eventuality ever come, and they eliminated that. As well, over the last 3 and 4 years, we've increased employee and employer contributions, and we joined with two other funds last year to proactively reduce our investment return assumption from 8.5 to 8. The cost of doing that was absorbed by the fund. I won't take you through the others, but there are a number of key architectural features that have been modified as well. And the way I like to sort of demonstrate how this plays out is through the lens of our contribution sufficiency or deficiency. And from my perspective, sitting in the seat as the fiduciary, I think that what that tells you is what decisions you're making within a 1 to 5 year time period, how are they turning out? And we look at the start of fiscal year 2012, these numbers are not good. We're at a 6.4% deficiency, and through your help and assistance, the measures we just talked about, and frankly, an allocation of $7 million of funding, we have taken this fund now, by the time the final contribution rates are phased in, this fund is slated to be at only a 0.6% deficiency on an actuarial basis and a 0.28 on a market basis. In this business where things can vary from year to year, as you've seen, these are about as good as getting to even as you can do. So I congratulate our board and the legislature for getting the fund into this shape. Of course, that brings us today to talking about mortality. I want to be clear, when we close the FY15 lens, we like what we see. This fund is on great trajectory. It's got a contribution sufficiency where it needs to be, but we want to deal with mortality. Now, we're on a slightly different experience study timetable than the three state funds. We won't have our experience study until later, but it's clear to us, looking at these studies, we have a very similar population, especially compared to TRA, for example. We know this issue exists now. We don't think it's prudent to wait to address it. The fund is experiencing a mortality improvement today. So with that, and as well, we share the actuary of two other funds, we believe we have sufficient evidence to get a very clear estimate of the impact on this fund, and we're choosing and our board is choosing to deal with this right now. If we flip to the next page, we want to walk you through some of the background of how we think about this mortality cost, again, this extra 2 years, and how we propose to deal with it. If you look currently at SPTRFA's contribution rates, you'll see a white line on the left-hand side for FY16. That's this year. Our rates for the employee are currently at 7%, and our employer rate is currently 6%. When we finish with the implementation and the phase-in of contribution increases that were passed in 2013, our fund, if you look at the 2017 line, will be at a 7.5% contribution for employees and a 6.5% for employers. In order to deal with the mortality costs, and we'll walk you through exactly how that breaks out, as well as to regain parity between employees and employers, we propose a two-step increase. We propose that in FY17, which is consistent, I believe, with TRA's implementation date, we propose that the employer portion be raised to 7.5%. We propose that the next year it be raised another 0.5%. In total, that's a 1.5% increase. And I think it's a fair question to ask. I haven't mentioned an employee increase in that. We're very comfortable, our board is comfortable, not increasing the employer portion for several reasons. One, our employer portion, when we're finished with the increases, will be at 7.5%. That's already above the national median that you can see in the upper right-hand side, as well as it's in parity with TRS and above the others. We think 7.5% represents a fair price for our employees to pay for their benefits. As well, over last year and this year, with the changes we're proposing to the triggers, and we'll talk more about that in a second, last year's change of the CPI plus 5, this year's change to eliminate triggers, means our employees, our members, will have contributed combined about 1.1% of pay. So putting together their higher rate in 2017, the contribution they'll have made by eliminating triggers last year and this year, as well as the national median, we think that 7.5% on employees represents a very fair trade. If we continue on to the next page, we can walk you through how we get to these numbers. When we take 2015's actual results on an actuarial basis, which is a more conservative approach in this case, and we include the impact of mortality, we will have a deficiency of 3.10. Then we take into account already statutorily passed contribution increases that will be phased in over the next several years. That gets us another 1%. Now we're solving for a 2.10 problem. Taking into account the benefit pickup of eliminating triggers this year, our employees this year will contribute 0.6, and we're asking the employer contribution of 1.5 to bring us to a net even. I'd be happy to talk more about why we think eliminating the triggers makes sense. I know we've heard a lot of testimony on that, and if that's sufficient, I'll leave it with saying that we agree wholeheartedly that eliminating the triggers is the right answer. We've also included in the back page more complete information on all of the funding categories and lines. We'd be happy to answer any questions, but I think that's the summary of our proposals.
Are there any questions? I am temporarily chairing here. So let me just summarize that, Ms. Schertz, by the time the phase in with the new proposal, you would be then comparable to TRA with a 7.5% and a 7.5% from employer and employee. Plus the employer is paying a supplemental to because of past underfunding.
Correct. In 2017, Madam Chair, if we do nothing, we will not be comparable. If we implement our proposal in the first year, 2017, we'd implement a 1% increase. That will mean our employee rate will be consistent with TRA's, but our employer rate would still lag by a full 1%.
Mm-hmm.
The following year, and again, we're working with our employer on this. We understand that doing it in 1 year would be difficult from a budgeting perspective. So adding in another 50 basis points the next year takes us to 8. So we would lag by 50 basis points the TRA proposal. But we think that that solves mortality, and we think it puts the contribution rates on the right path.
So in the end, your employer contributions would be 0.5% higher than your employee.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
And that assumes continuing appropriations from the legislature?
It does.
Or past underfunding?
That's correct.
Okay. Are there any questions? Anyone else? Okay, thank you very much. I think we're taking testimony. Yes, right. So why don't we take some testimony, and if anyone thinks of questions, we can always bring you back up.
Thank you.
First, Ms. Kelleher from the Minnesota School Boards Association. With friends. Mr. Kroonquist, and is this Mr. Amoroso?
Yes,
as
ma'am.
Well? So we have a team. All right, let's start with Ms. Kelleher then.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We represent every elected school board member in the state of Minnesota. And to start out, I want to say that MSBA wholeheartedly supports participation in TRA, and we realize this is an important benefit, which contributes to our board members' ability to attract and retain employees. I'd like to give you a little history on TRA. If we look back to 2006, we started at 5% employer contribution. That was raised in 2007. 2010, over a four-year period, that was taken up to 7.5%. And MSBA is lucky enough to have a board member on the TRA board, and as this sufficiency plan has come forward, we voted against it there, and we have real concerns about it here. Basically, school districts are somewhat unlike counties and cities. We do not have a levy for increased pension costs. We have to manage those within our school budgets, and we are concerned that the deficiency of $43 million a year is a significant hit to school districts around the state. We believe that either the state has to give us a dedicated levy authority, similar to the cities and counties, to cover these increased pension costs at this point, or in fact provide aid to cover it going forward. With that, I do want to draw the committee's attention to the MRS proposal. They are talking about advocating for additional funding going forward as part of their package. You did not hear that same method of approach by TRA. They, in fact, would only move the pension piece forward and not, in fact, also work on funding increases going forward. That's all I have, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Kelleher. Is there any questions for her? Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Ms. Kelleher, you said dedicated levy authority or additional aid. And is that the order that of your priority or your preference?
Madam Chair and Representative Murphy, you always ask the best questions. And I'll give you a gold star for this one. They are in reverse order. We would really prefer aid, then levy authority, to confront these ongoing increased costs. And, you know, the third time in 10 years to have this fund come back for additional funds from the school district, it's just a hit we can't take. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Keller, any other comments at this point, just as I'm re-entering here?
No, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. I have next on the list Mr. Amoroso, so if you would like to go ahead and share your comments today, sir, welcome and state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gary Amoroso, I serve as the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. We have as our membership all of the superintendent of schools in the state of Minnesota, as well as other district-level administrators. I would echo many of the concepts that comments that Ms. Kelleher made. Our organization was one of the organizations that worked in a collaborative fashion with some other organizations and TRA last year to come up with the plan, which was implemented to get the funding back to an appropriate level. Our employees each raised their contribution 0.5% each year for 4 years, and so did our school districts. And we're thankful that TRA involved us in this conversation. We've had meetings with them. We've talked about this. And we also understand the significance of making sure that we have a system that is in good financial state. And we know that needs to be done. But as Ms. Kelleher said, if we were to move forward with providing a need for an additional 1% to come from our school districts, we need to have that funding paid for. I think most of you know that next year the school districts are receiving a 2% increase on the formula as a result of the action of the legislature last year. If we were not to provide additional funding for our districts, you're looking at probably somewhere between, and depending on the district and the expenses of the district, between 0.5% and 1% of that increase would have to go to pay for this And again, we would be hamstringing our school districts that are already being challenged with the funding that we've received over the last, 10-plus years. We're thankful for the additional funding, but if this type of a mandate would come forward and over the next year or two we didn't have the additional funding with it, we would be challenged. And I don't think that's in anyone's best interest. So we would request that if this were to move forward, that there would be funding provided by the state. And as Ms. Keller said, we prefer to see the aid versus just providing levy authority to districts. And secondly, I would feel remiss if I didn't just have a couple comments regarding the reemployment annuity piece that was referenced. We have a teacher shortage in this state, and it's a significant teacher shortage. And it's not just in greater Minnesota, ladies and gentlemen. It's happening in the metro. And one of the things that we did as we toured the state this year with our members was we talked about these proposals. Again, we were very thankful that TRA had had conversations with us. They wanted us to go out and get feedback. And the feedback that I heard was that if we began to create a system whereby if a teacher was reemployed, and I'm not talking about as a substitute teacher, but we have teachers that retire, and then the districts cannot find another licensed person for the position, so that person comes back into the job, and it's a full-time job, and I understand that they're collecting a pension, which is perfectly legal, and they would then be collecting their paycheck as a teacher. Under the proposal, we would be taking away one out of every $3 after $46,000. And most of those teachers are going to be on the high end of the salary schedule, and that is going to become a disincentive to have our teachers employed at a time when we're experiencing a teacher shortage in the state. Might there be a time down the road where this type of a proposal would have more merit? Maybe there will be. But I think at this point in time in the state, with the experiences that we are having in our state of having teachers to work with our children, this would not be a good time to do that. If the Pension Commission felt they needed to go in this direction, I would then look at saying that the $46,000 threshold must be significantly increased as to lessen the damage that would be done for that teacher that would become reemployed. And I also understand that this would have an impact on our members as superintendents as well as with principals. We are in a time of shortage for teachers. We have less candidates for the role of superintendent. We have less candidates for the role of principal. In my opinion, now is not the time to create a disincentive for these people to come back into the system and work with our children. And I would stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Amoroso. Any questions at this time from members or Mr. Amoroso? Seeing none, Mr. Kroonquist, if you would.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. And I will be brief because my comments are very similar to Ms. Kelleher and Mr. Amoroso. We fully understand that the TRA needs to be brought back into stability. We support that. But as my colleagues pointed out, our school districts are not in a position to just absorb that 1% cost. Representative Anderson asked about the impact. We have a survey in the field right now trying to gather that information, so we'll be happy to share that with you when we do have it. But our preliminary results tell us that it'll be about a $50 to $60 per pupil increase, that 1% impact. And so that's going to be about a 1% formula increase that we would be needing to cover that cost. So I'll leave it at that, Mr. Chairman and members.
Mr. Kroonquist, just to qualify or to clarify, I should say, your comment about $60 to $70 per academic year or per biennium?
Mr. Chairman, that'd be a per year annual cost.
Questions for Mr. Kroonquist from members of the commission? If not, thank you for your time and your testimony today. At this time, I will open it up to members of the public before members ask any other questions or we receive anything at this point. Is there anyone wishing to testify on the matter before the commission today? Sir, please come down and identify yourself for the record, and we'll ask you to spell your last name for us, too, so we make sure we get it correctly in the on the record today. Welcome.
Thank you, committee. My name is Rick Keller, and officially represent the Twice Exceptional and Print Disabled. Briefly, I only come up here.
Sir, just one quick moment. Could you spell your last name so we get it properly spelled?
The name is Heller, H-E-L-L-E-R.
Proceed, sir.
make sure the record reflects unofficially representing, because we haven't had a we have lingual words in the statute right now, like twice exceptional. It would be important until we clarify that. So thank you again for testifying today. I come here to testify to make sure that these documents become more fully accessible for the public. I'm not sure. I believe the legislature has exempted themselves from Statute 16EO 3.09, which makes content accessible for the public, which, frankly, screen readers, for instance, will read all the content out loud, including the images. So my understanding is there are some state agency here documents that are provided. However, since there are public documents from profit and nonprofit, perhaps, that you would make sure that when they provide those to your committee, that they would be made fully accessible in electronic format. It's my understanding the legislature does a lot of scanning of documents, which creates an image and, frankly, takes the transparency out of government for participation. So I would encourage you to look at that as well. These documents need to be functional in a meaningful way, again, for public engagement. Thank you again for this opportunity to speak, perhaps in the future. And if someone wants to get back to me, or if the parties would like to yield to the chair, that they will make sure that these documents become fully accessible and functional for this reader, that would be helpful as well.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony. We are sensitive to that issue, and as a legislature and as a commission are working to that end. It does take some time for us to be able to get the things in place that we need to, but thank you for sharing your comments and your concerns with us, because we do share those as a commission as well.
Thank you.
Anyone else wishing to testify? Anyone else wishing to testify today before the commission on the matters before the commission? Well, that is going to conclude our discussion. We are not taking any action items today on the information. This is the first of a number of hearings that we will be having relative to what the 2016 pensions bill would look like. And I thank everyone for their time and their interest in the matter. And we are going to adjourn, and we will reconvene tomorrow at 9 o'clock for the day two of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. We are adjourned.
Day two.
Members, you may leave your information at your seats. There will be no other use of the room until we come back tomorrow.
Occupation. That reminded me when you said day two. It was like